Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you back to our High Holiday Bootcamp. This is our second session of the High Holiday Bootcamp. Topic tonight is the holy day of Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year on the Jewish calendar, and specifically the topic tonight within the genre of Yom Kippur, the title of the class is Jews in Shoes. Jews in Shoes. If you're wondering what Jews in Shoes means, stay tuned as we explore this incredibly soulful topic. Soulful. Tongue in cheek. Yes. 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 Yes.
I'm not sure whether to groan or laugh.
Yeah. Well, we encourage both. That's how we roll here. Okay. So let's begin by talking about Yom Kippur. So what are some of the themes of Yom Kippur that come to mind when you think about this holy day? Yom Kippur themes.
No leather shoes, am I right?
Say it again?
No leather shoes.
What else? What else? What's the major theme of Yom Kippur?
Fasting.
Good.
Atonement.
Good. That's what I was looking for. We know it as the Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement. It's a day of forgiveness. Day of Atonement. If you look at the word, the English word atonement, you can break it down into three words, not really, but sort of three segments. At one mint. Atonement, at one mint. It's a day in which we are at one with God. It's a day in which we are the closest to God. Now, let's take a look. Open up your booklets. Open up your books immediately to the first text. Text number one. This is from the Torah, from the book of Leviticus. You can find it on page number 224, and it details some of the biblical discussion about the holy day of Yom Kippur. Ray, please get us started.
And God spoke to Moses, saying, "But on the 10th of this seventh month, it is a day of atonement. It shall be a holy occasion for you. You shall afflict yourself, and you shall offer up a fire offering to God. You shall not perform any work on that very day, for it is a day of atonement, for you to gain atonement before the Lord your God. For any person who will not be afflicted on that very day shall be cut off from its people. And any person who performs any work on that very day, I will destroy that person from amidst its people. You shall not perform any work. This is an eternal statute throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. It is a complete day of rest for you, and you shall afflict yourself. On the ninth of the month, in the evening, from evening to evening, you shall observe your rest day."
Thank you. So tell me, please, and this is open up to everybody in the room, tell me what do you learn about Yom Kippur from these verses in Leviticus? What do we know about Yom Kippur based on these verses? Okay, let's talk about themes.
You're expected to atone and do nothing else.
Good, atonement, that's the major theme, and that's what we're focused on. Good, what else?
What does that afflict?
Yeah, what does that mean?
Word for here.
What is the whole affliction? Are you saying what's the Hebrew of it?
No, I'm wondering why it says afflicted, because you think of afflicted as something that comes from without onto you rather than...
Well, we're going to get to affliction in a second. We're going to have you heard my jokes. We're going to get to affliction in a second, and we'll speak about that theme. But good, it's a day of atonement and a day of affliction. We're going to explain that. What else? What else do we have from this reading? What else?
So I have oneness.
Forgiveness, good, connection, atonement. Now we have affliction also. What else? How long is Yom Kippur? What does the Torah tell us?
One day.
From when to when? From night to night, from evening to evening. May Erev ad, right? It says, May Erev ad Erev, Tish B'su Shabbatchem. From evening to evening, you shall observe your rest day. Okay, what else? What day of the month is it? And which month is it? 10th of the seventh month. We explained last week that the seventh month on our calendar is the first month, Jewish math, right? We're always late. We're 7 months late when we start the year. Year begins, it's already the seventh month. We're well deep. So the 10th day of the seventh month is Yom Kippur that's coming up, by the way, this Tuesday night into Wednesday night. Good. So these are the themes that we have from this reading. One word that stands out, and I agree with Maya, one word that stands out is this idea of affliction. Multiple times the Torah tells us that it's a day of affliction. It says in the second paragraph of that text, you shall afflict yourselves. And the fourth paragraph, it says, any person who will not be afflicted will be cut off. And in the final paragraph, it says again, you shall afflict yourselves. Three times, affliction. What does affliction mean? Many different cultures, and others have their own forms of societal affliction. But in the Jewish understanding, traditional Jewish understanding of this text, affliction does not mean that you are having someone inflict pain upon you, or that there's some sort of malady that comes from without. Rather, affliction, in this context, in the context of Yom Kippur, as understood by our sages throughout history, means that it is a self-inflicted affliction by withholding oneself from normative activities. So affliction, the Torah's usage of the word affliction means that we're going to refrain. We're going to hold ourselves back from various things that we would normally and ordinarily do. So it's about abstaining from basic physical activities. What are the physical activities that we're abstaining from on the day of Yom Kippur? Number one?
Eating.
We put eating and drinking together in the same category. Number two, what else?
Working.
Huh?
Working.
Working, okay, that was stated. Good. What else?
Bathing.
Good.
Cleaning.
What? Cleaning the house? Now remember, it's about self. It's about abstaining within oneself from things that normally we do to take care of ourselves. So these are all things that are listed. We'll get to it in a second. Let's take a look at Maimonides, text number two. Maimonides here clarifies five categories of affliction, five classic things, areas of abstention that we do not do on Yom Kippur. Hugh, do you want to read or we'll pass? David.
There was another positive commandment on Yom Kippur to refrain from eating and drinking, as is stated, you shall afflict your souls. According to the oral tradition, it has been taught what is meant by afflicting one's soul, fasting. Whoever fasts on this day fulfills a positive commandment. Whoever eats or drinks on this day negates the observance of this positive commandment and violates a negative commandment, as it is stated, any soul that does not afflict itself will be cut off. Similarly, according to the oral tradition, it has been taught that it is forbidden to wash, anoint oneself, wear shoes, or engage in sexual relations on this day. It is a mitzvah to refrain from these activities in the same way one refrains from eating and drinking.
So Maimonides clarifies, and this has been canonized in Jewish law for thousands of years, that how do we observe Yom Kippur? How do we fulfill this biblical mandate to afflict ourselves on this day? How is it a day of affliction? So number one, so five categories of abstention. Number one, no eating or drinking. Number two, no bathing. Number three, no applying oils. It says anoint oneself. No applying any oils or perfumes. Number four, we don't wear shoes. We abstain from footwear, which is going to be a major focus of tonight's class. Number five, no physical intimacy. These are the five categories that are prohibited for the 26 hours of Yom Kippur from evening to evening. The big question here is, though, Maimonides clarifies the Jewish understanding, the Jewish legal understanding of the biblical verse that says afflict ourselves. What we don't understand yet, perhaps, is why are we meant to afflict ourselves on the Day of Atonement? What is the connection between atonement and affliction? So tell me, it's a Day of Atonement, I need to speak with God, ask forgiveness, be one with God at one moment. But what's this whole abstention, no this, no that, no the other? Why is the day marked by, in a sense, paining ourselves by not having these things?
Well, I've always thought it was so that you could focus inward and not... And
you could write this stuff.
But I didn't.
Take a look. You're right. Text number three. Gemma.
The message of this mitzvah is, out of his kindness towards his creatures, God established one day in the year to atone for their sins through repentance. As I wrote at length in the Parasha of
Achrei Mot,
regarding the commandment of Yom Kippur service. Therefore, we were commanded to fast on this day. As food and drink and the other sensual pleasures propel the corporal self towards desire and sin and thwart the wise soul's search for the truth, which is the service of God and his ethics, which are good and sweet for anyone with knowledge. Such conduct, it is not fitting on the day one comes to judgment in front of his master, to come with a soul dimmed and distracted by food and drink, with a thought of the material which is in it. Inasmuch as a person is judged according to his deeds at that time, it is good for him to strengthen his wise soul and to subdue the corporal before it on the glorious day, so that the soul be worthy and ready to receive atonement, and that the veil of desires not prevent it.
So this is very poetic language that he uses, the chinuch, and the translation is a little bit awkward, but here's the point. The point is, the chinuch writes, Sefer HaChinuch, by the way, written by Rav Aaron of Barcelona, he explains every mitzvah. All 613 mitzvah, he explains them philosophically, in a way that makes sense, that you can understand it. Why were we obligated to do this thing or not do that thing? He says, why are we obligated on Yom Kippur to refrain from physical activities such as eating and drinking and other physical pleasures? And he says it's very simple. Because the more we're focused on the food, the less we're focused on the soul. It's simple. It's like a seesaw. The more you're involved in grilling, the less you're involved in praying. That's it. That's the way it works, right? It's Super Bowl Sunday. You're having a barbecue. No one has a barbecue. It's winter. Whatever. You're eating wings and drinking beer, and it's a whole thing, and it's a whole party. Mazel tov. You're probably not really connecting with God unless you're praying really strongly that your team should win, but that's another story. So the point is like this. When it comes to trying to develop a sincere and a sensitive spiritual connection, the antidote to that, the kryptonite of that, is indulgence in material pleasures. The more indulgent we are, the less in the material, the less sensitive we are to the spiritual. And the less we focus on the physical, the more we can focus on the spiritual. So therefore, we have one day a year in which we're meant to be completely holy, with a W, spiritual. Holy, holy. Right? That's what the day is all about. Total day of soul. On the day of soul, the day of neshama, the day of atonement, of one minute, if you will, on that day, there's no physical indulgences. We don't worry about food. We don't worry about drink. We don't worry about anything else. Nothing physical. No physical pleasures. No physical, no anointing of oils and no perfumes and no intimacy. None of that. It's all about focusing on the soul, getting in touch with who we really are and getting in touch with God. Correct.
So that you're totally present, and if you can, can change the subject, you don't get as deep as you would because it's more. That's why, I have this low attention span.
Well, I think your point is very well taken. If we're all gathered around the buffet on Yom Kippur, we're probably not praying at that moment. We're either jostling or we're eating or we're schmoozing about the food, and it's not. And that's not the point of Yom Kippur. 364 days a year, we focus on. We also include the material pursuits. One day a year, it's out of a whole year. It's one day that we focus completely on soul. We don't worry about the body. The body still exists, but we don't feed the body. We don't take care of the body. We don't beautify the body. The body just is. We focus on the soul. And as we hear, as we feel those hunger pangs, and the body kind of says, what about me? You forgot about me. You usually feed me. What happened? You tell the body, don't worry, bubala, don't worry, you'll be fine. Don't be yingala means little one. You'll be fine. Don't worry, we'll take care of you. Tonight we'll break the fast. We'll give you a bagel. You'll be happy. It's like you've never fasted. It'll be like you never fasted. I always say this. It's like when you're fasting, it's like you never ate. And when you break the fast, it's like you never fasted. It's like so extreme. But that also should evoke a sense of how silly it is to run after the body 24/7. It's like one day without food and the body begins going like, it goes haywire. Take it easy. The body's not so important anyway. It's a day of soul. That's the message. Therefore, we abstain from these five categories of physical accoutrements, etc. We abstain so that we can focus. We abstain from the material so that we can focus on the spiritual. Make sense? There's one category here that seems a little bit out of place. And that is our focus, which is on the Jimmy Choos. On the shoes. On the Choos. Okay? Why? I figured we would speak in designer euphemisms instead of saying shoes repeatedly. So I prepared a list. I have Stuart Weitzman. Yeah? Yes. Jimmy Choo. Alexander McQueen. How do you pronounce this? Mew Mew? Mew Mew? Is that it? Is that French?
It's fashion.
It's fashion? Fashion is its own language. Christian Louboutin. Louboutin? Is that Louboutin? Louboutin? Has an I there. Whatever. How do you pronounce this? Gukkake? I'm joking. It's Gucci. That I know. This one I haven't heard of. Manola Blahnik? Manola Blahnik? Since when? No, that's fake news. That's not real. And Louis Vuitton, is that Italian or is that French?
French.
It's French? All right, French gets like at least four out of these eight or three out of these eight. I know there are more. That's all I have here on my list. I Googled top shoes. I figured we would just use these, again, interchangeably for shoes. So the question is, I get it. God says, don't distract your body. Don't focus on the food. Don't focus on, you know, the makeup and the anointing and the perfumes and the bathing and all that stuff. But what's wrong with the Blahniks? What's wrong with it? What's wrong with the shoes? Why? What's the problem with that? So text 4 clarifies that the prohibition of Yom Kippur regarding shoes is not that you can't wear any shoes. You can't wear shoes of a certain material. Text number 4, Sarah.
What does the prohibition against wearing shoes entail? It is forbidden to wear leather shoes or leather sandals, even on one foot, regardless of whether one is at home or in the public domain. The prohibition applies everywhere. It is even forbidden to wear a wooden shoe that is lined with leather. If possible, one should be stringent and not wear a wooden shoe, even if it is not lined with leather.
I know all of you are running to put on wooden shoes. It's like, oh my God, I got my best wooden shoes. I really want to break them out. It's going to be amazing. No, hold back on the wooden shoes. Do people wear wooden shoes? Is this a real thing?
In Holland.
Oh, Holland? Why are they wearing wooden shoes in Holland? Is this real?
Yes.
It's a what? Oh, it's a clog?
Yeah,
clogs. Clogs. Not Crocs. I'm joking. So 1 second. We'll see if soon Crocs are good. Continue, please.
Okay. It is, however, permissible to wear sandals or shoes made of reeds, straw, cloth, or other substances, because then one's feet feel the bumps on the ground. Indeed, he feels as if he is barefoot. Moreover, the sages forbade only a shoe, and a foot covering that is not made of leather is considered a garment, not a shoe.
I love that's like, that's the ultimate fashion drop right there. If your shoe is not made out of leather, it's not a shoe. Boom, that's it. And that's how it ends up. This is the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch, authored by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And he writes clearly, the prohibition of Yom Kippur regarding footwear does not mean you cannot wear anything on your feet over the socks. You can wear what we would call shoes or slippers or sandals, but you cannot wear something made of leather. So as long as it's not leather, you can break out your Converse. You can break out your Crocs. Crocs are fine. Crocs are kosher. Even sound kosher, Crocs are kosher, not the actual Crocs that we'll leave in the other books that we were talking about. Right, but the actual Crocs are fine, Converse are fine, other forms of sneakers are fine, as long as they are not made of leather. Get your synthetics, yeah.
It says because one's feet feel the bumps on the ground.
Yes.
Are you supposed to feel uncomfortable? He gives you...
Great question. He gives two reasons for it. It's not so clear in the English, but in the Hebrew he says there's two reasons. Two understandings of this. He says, number one, So he says, leather is problematic, but you can wear, it is permissible to wear, sandals or shoes made of other substances, including reed, straw, cloth, etc. Why? Number one, because then you're going to feel the ground, so it's not much of a separation. And number two, moreover, second reason, the sages only forbade a shoe that is, the prohibition is only against a shoe, and something not made of leather is not considered to be a shoe. It's considered to be a garment. So there's really two answers given. In other words, if you focus on the first answer, then Crocs, where maybe you don't feel, or a thicker synthetic shoe or sneaker where you don't feel the ground, might also be problematic. But according to the second rationale, where only leather is considered a shoe, then it's not a shoe. Are you with me on that?
Do both criteria have to be filled or only
one? It seems like either or. He's saying moreover.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is why, if you go into a synagogue on Yom Kippur, you'll find many types of footwear. There are many options of non-leather footwear that are completely halachically okay according to Jewish law, and it doesn't have to be a situation where the foot is in agony because it is, you know, stepping on whatever it's stepping on. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
So is the prohibition against shoes or leather? Can you wear a leather belt?
The prohibition is against leather footwear.
So, but you can
leather
wear
belt
leather
is
belt.
Fine. Correct. Yes. Leather belt is fine. It's only the leather footwear. So again, the prohibition is against shoes. And how do you define a shoe? A leather shoe. So the prohibition is not against leather, it's against shoes. But we're defining what is a shoe, what is the material of a shoe? It's leather. And maybe wood. that's like thrown in there. And maybe wood, right? Better not to wear wood. Okay, good. So this is text number four. So at this point, it should be clarified that we have five prohibitions on Yom Kippur. These are means of afflicting oneself in keeping with the biblical mandate to afflict oneself on Yom Kippur. And number four, the fourth affliction, as stated by Maimonides, is abstaining from wearing shoes, specifically leather shoes. Okay, and so the question we're going to ask now is, what's the deal with the leather shoes? Like, why? Is it because they're too fancy? Is it because they're too comfortable? Is it because they're... Like, what's the problem with the leather shoes? What's the problem with shoes? Leather shoes are what makes a shoe, so let's not focus on the leather for a moment. Let's assume that all the shoes are leather, because that's what defines a shoe according to Jewish law. That's what makes a shoe. Why are we not wearing shoes? What's the problem with the shoes? It's too luxurious. It's like we're afraid that...
It's hard to work without shoes on.
I know, right? But it's like, what? So we're saying, like, don't eat and drink, don't be distracted by various things, and don't wear shoes. What is it, such a distraction?
Too comfortable.
It's too comfortable. What's going on with the shoes? What's the deal with the shoes? That's what everyone wants to know. What's the deal with the shoes?
Yeah.
Jerry Seinfeld, what's the deal with the shoes? Right. Text number five reminds us that there are blessings that we say every morning regarding blessings that God gives us for our material comfort. One of them actually regards shoes. Text number five, Kate.
Initially, the sages ordained that each of the morning blessings should be recited at the time its obligation is entered. Thus, when one wakes from sleep, he should say, Elohai Neshma. When he hears a rooster crow, he should recite the blessing, Hanasen.
Asechvibina.
When he puts on his shirt while laying down, he should recite the blessing, Mabish Arumimim. When he touches his eyes, using his shirt as a buffer, he should recite the blessing.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't decide to translate these things. These are various morning blessings that speak about the things that we are grateful for so in the morning. So number one, the first blessing that we have is about our soul returning from us. That's Elokai Neshama. Then when we hear a rooster crow, you thank God for giving the rooster intelligence to know when it's morning, right? We might be thankful for our alarm clocks today and our cell phones, but back then it was the rooster and the fact that the rooster knows when the dawn is every morning. When we put on our clothes, we get dressed, so we recite the blessing that thanksgiving for being blessed with clothing. the ability to open up our eyes. We thank God for being able to see in the morning. Continue.
When he sits up, he should recite the blessing, Matthias.
Which means untying the bound. And it was the idea of our backs working and being able to stand up, is that?
For he is moving his limbs, which were as if fettered the night, the entire night. When he stands up, he should recite the blessing, Zotef Tefumen, for his body was bent over throughout the night and is now standing upright. When he blesses, when he places his feet on the ground, he should recite the blessing,
which means that God placed earth upon the water, dry land amidst the water, and that's what we stand on, firm ground. Continue.
When he puts on his shoes, he should recite the blessing, Shesa Lekol Zorki, who has provided me with all I need. One should not alter the wording of the blessing and use the plural form.
This gets very technical. Okay, forget, you can skip that. All right, so... So, okay, that's all we need. So here's the point. The point is that originally the blessings were instituted to be said as we go through the day. So as we get ready in the morning and as we go on our day, every time we encounter another wonderful gift from God, we should thank God for that gift and be grateful in that moment. But as the years went by, so the way it works now is after we're dressed and pretty much settled in the morning routine, so then we open up the prayer book and recite the list of all the blessings, all the dozen or so blessings that include all the things that we've already enjoyed up to that point. One of the blessings, which was just mentioned, is Sha'asali Kalsarki, which means thanking God for providing me with all that I need. Specifically, though, what does it mean that God has provided me with all I need? Our sages understood this, and the way they instituted this blessing is it actually refers to footwear, shoes. Thanking God for all I need means shoes. Which is why text number 6, Marlene, please read this one, text number 6.
The ninth of Av and Yom Kippur, you do not say this blessing.
Why not? Why not the ninth of Av and Yom Kippur? Why don't we say the blessing for God, that God provides us for, with all that we need? Because we don't wear
shoes.
Leather shoes. We don't wear leather shoes, so we don't say that blessing. So in fact, in the Machzor, in the high holiday prayer, special high holiday prayer book for Yom Kippur, you'll notice in the morning blessings, that blessing, Sha'asa L'Kaltzarki, thanking God for giving me all my needs, that one's taken out. Even though we have many other needs, but we don't have the shoes, that's it. Strike it from the record. Say it the next morning. And likewise, Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, we also don't wear leather shoes. Those 2 days are days in which we don't recite this blessing. So what this should evoke is a certain clarity in the observance of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day of atonement. It's a day of soul. It's a day of connection. It's a day in which we don't, in which we neglect, so to speak. We don't pay attention too much to the body, and we don't wear leather shoes. And the question that I asked before comes back, and the question is, what is the big deal with the shoes? So if you wore shoes, you couldn't pray. You would be so distracted. What's going on? What's wrong? It almost seems like shoes are somehow unsavory and a distraction to the holiness of Yom Kippur. Why? Are shoes bad? I get it. If we're dealing with food, it's a distraction. If we're dealing with other things of pleasure and intimacy, etc., I can get how that's a distraction. But what's the deal with the shoes? So let's jump in to subsequent texts and discover where shoes are found in Scripture and in other sources. So I'll ask you the question. Where do you find... Can you recall, without looking into the text, certainly you could if you'd like to, but without necessarily jumping into the text, can you think of a time in the, can you think of a story in the Bible, in the Torah, where somebody is told to take off their shoes?
Moses at the burning bush.
Moses at the burning bush, correct. Text number 7.
Moses was pasturing the flocks of Jethro, his father-in-law, the chief of Midian, and he led the flocks after the free pasture land, and he came to the mountain of God, Horeb. An angel of God appeared to him in a flame of fire from within the thorn bush, and behold, the thorn bush was burning with fire, but the thorn bush was not being consumed. So Moses said, "Let me turn now and see this great spectacle. Why does the thorn bush not burn up?" God saw that he had turned to see, and God called to him from within the thorn bush, and he said to Moses, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not draw near here. take your shoes off your feet, because the place upon which you stand is holy soil.
Okay, first of all, thank you for the God impersonation. It was like, it was divine. Classic. Okay, text number 7 tells us the story of Moses' first encounter with God and being asked, being chosen to lead the Jewish people out of Egypt. So Moses famously grows up in Egypt. And in fact, he grows up, according to the biblical story, he grows up in the palace. He is adopted. He's rescued by the daughter of Pharaoh, grows up in the palace. At a certain point in time, he knows that he's a Jew, and he sympathizes with the Jewish experience, i.e. the slavery, and he rescues a Jew from a beating by the hands of an Egyptian. He slays the Egyptian, and Pharaoh wishes to kill him. So he runs away. He has to bounce out of Egypt, and he goes to Midian. And in Midian, he's by the well, and he meets a young lady. Her name is Zipporah, and he gets married to her. And he works for her dad, for his father-in-law, whose name was Yisro or Jethro, and he is a shepherd. And in the famous story, so Moses runs after a wayward sheep, so to speak, and the sheep runs all the way to Horeb. What is Horeb? To the mountain of God, Horeb. Which mountain is that? It would later be known as? Mount Sinai. Horeb is Sinai. Mount Sinai. So he runs all the way to Mount Sinai. I don't have the mileage on that, but that's what it says. And there he sees a bush, and the bush is a spectacle because it's on fire, but it's not being consumed. You know, usually something that's on fire, it's being lessened, and here it's not being consumed, and God speaks to him. But before God presents the mission that Moses should return to Egypt and tell Pharaoh, let my people go, etc., before he launches into the mission, God tells him to do one thing. And what is it? Take off your shoes. Why? Because the place upon which you stand is holy soil. So I'll ask you a question. Are shoes associated with holiness?
No.
Or the opposite? When a place is holy, what do? Take off. What's another source for this? Where else do we see in Jewish history, in ancient Jewish times, that people would take off their shoes on hallowed grounds?
In the temple,
in the Beis HaMikdash. Text number 8, Sandrine.
Similarly, anyone involved with one of the temple services must be standing on the floor. If there was anything intervening between himself and the ground, he was standing on an utensil, an animal, or a colleague's foot, his service is invalid.
It's like, oh, you stepped on my toe, you got to do the whole sacrifice again. That's the worst. So again, Maimonides is clarifying that in order to be deemed a kosher service in the temple by the priests have to be standing directly on the ground of the temple. Continue. No, this is a mistake. This is actually not a translation. This is meant to be a bridge paragraph to the next reading, which is it shouldn't be in the student book. It's from the teacher's book. It shouldn't be in the student book. But don't worry about it. But so what we have here is the halacha, is the law, and that is that a kohen, a priest working in the temple, is not supposed to have any separation between the foot in the ground. Maimonides clarifies this, and the Mishnah in text number 9 tells us that it's not only true for the priest, it's also true for anybody that visits the Temple Mount. And
one may not enter the Temple Mount with his staff or wearing shoes, with his money belt, or with the dust on his feet.
So the Mishnah says that when you approach the Temple Mount, you have to come in pristine condition. So no money belt. It's not a place of commerce. Leave your credit cards at home, right? What was that tagline? What was the don't leave home without it, unless you're going to the temple, and then leave home
without it.
Unless you go, yeah, and then leave home without it. So no money belt, no staff, no walking stick, no dust on your feet. Your feet have to be clean, and no wearing shoes. Again, we have this theme that when you're standing on holy ground, on hallowed ground, you don't wear shoes. So again, are shoes good or maybe not good? Are they associated with holiness or non-holiness? What would you say?
Well, whether it's holiness or not, it seems like there should be a separation. Is the idea of shoes are not holy, or they shouldn't separate you from?
Well, hopefully the shoes aren't holy. Now, hold. No, I hear your question. I hear your question, but hold on. Let's read text number 10 to round out this discussion. Dan. So it seems clear, based on all of these source texts, from the biblical source text of Moses at the burning bush, from Maimonides in the Mishnah about the temple and the temple mount and the service in the temple, and from the Midrash of text number 10, which we just read, which talks about the idea that any place in which the divine presence is revealed, you cannot wear shoes. What it seems clear from all of these texts is that footwear, shoes, another one here, Louboutins, are the antithesis of holiness. Sorry, it's all apologies to the designers. If you're wearing shoes, you should take them off in a holy place. The question that we're going to ask is as follows. Seems like a clear connection and a correlation, but why? What is the problem? If you're in a holy place, what is the problem with wearing shoes? Maybe if you're in a holy place, you should wear a special hat to mark it. Maybe if you're in a holy place, you should wear high heels to get even more elevated. Why in a holy place are we wearing no shoes? What's with the no shoes?
Humble?
Okay. Why is that humble and not something else? I mean, we could think of many things that could humble us. No, that's a good point.
Grounding oneself.
Literally. Okay,
the
good.
The only physical barrier between you and the earth, and they already previously mentioned God making the ground from the water, so it's holy.
So you're saying it's holy, and therefore we're trying to connect with the good?
Well, in this part that we weren't supposed to look, read, it also seems to indicate that gloves are not, that you shouldn't wear gloves. Either.
No, that part you could read. No, that's fine.
It says nothing should intervene between the hand and the utensils.
Right.
So maybe,
but that's when doing the service, yeah.
So maybe shoes, but they didn't wear socks in those days.
They did
so
not wear socks.
You would think that socks should be prohibited too.
If they're leather socks, yeah, it's a problem.
Anyhow, it's anything that comes between you and
but
the...
What's the problem? So I'll ask the simple question. What is the problem with something intervening between your feet and the ground?
You don't want the shoe's soul interfere with your soul.
Ah, but how does... I love it. First of all, I love it. Second of all, though, my question is, but why does that cause a problem?
So leather comes from an animal that had a soul, and it's not... I mean, that connection's not there now.
I feel like you're going very heavily, like, what was her name? Alice? You're going down the rabbit hole. What just happened there? A little bit too much. It's a great point. Well, we see clearly. Yeah.
I was just going to say, if your mother has washed the floor,
right,
the first thing she says,
take off your shoes.
Dirt into my house.
Right. Right. So that works for the temple. But what about Moses by the burning bush? He's by a mountain. Like I don't think he's dragging any more dirt right there by the base of the mountain. I mean, you would think.
He's facing a shoe.
That is true. That is true. We don't know what that looks like. Right. Okay, good. That's a great point. Yeah.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that we come from the earth and we return to the earth? So there's a
possibly.
What about vulnerability?
Vulnerable. Okay, good. I like that. Good. Good, good, good.
If you take the Hindu approach, that since your kundalini goes through your head into the ground.
The what? What was the word they said?
The kundalini.
Oh, gazante.
Chug. The
straight
your
to the ground.
Feet
interesting.
Into the ground. So if you put shoes on, that's going to interrupt the
interesting.
Flow of your shoes.
What it seems, I like this. So I think a lot of the response, a lot of what you're saying, what all of you are saying, touches on this idea that what seems obvious or what seems clear is that we're not supposed to have something intervening between us and the ground. But the question is, why exactly not? And is there a beeping sound? It's
yes.
Just it's just randomly that I'm hearing.
Yes.
Oh, is that what that
is?
Huh. So awkward. We'll pretend like we don't hear it. We'll just ignore it. We're going to bring this back to a spiritual understanding, but not necessarily the sphero chart. I don't think we're not going to get that deeply into the mystical discussion, but we are going to get a little bit mystical. One thing that I want to point out is that it seems from all of the texts, all of the sources, all the discussions so far, that when we're in a state of holiness, it seems like we're not meant to have any separation between us and the ground, right? That's the implication. When it's a holy state or a holy place, whether it's a holy day of Yom Kippur or a holy place like the temple or the burning bush, we're not meant to have any separation, any intervening layers between our feet and the ground. Make sense? Yes? Okay. Which raises a question, one final question, based on a prophecy from Isaiah, from Yeshayahu HaNavi. Isaiah writes extensively about prophecies regarding the Messianic era, the coming of Mashiach. He famously writes about the time when the wolf will lie with the lamb, the leopard shall lie with the kid, the calf and the lion cub, many of them non-kosher animals in the prophecy of Isaiah. A small child shall lead them. So famously he talks about the Messianic era as a time when there will be peace on earth, amongst people, amongst animals, amongst the natural world itself, a time that, frankly, all decent moral human beings are waiting for, a time of literally world peace and goodness. Isaiah continues the prophecy. I've summarized text 12a. Let's jump straight to text 12b. Please read text 12b from Isaiah. What page are we on? Page 238.
And it shall come to pass that on that day God shall continue to apply his hand a second time to acquire the rest of his people that will remain from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Sumeria and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. And he shall raise a banner to the nations, and he shall gather the lost of Israel, and the scattered ones of Judah he shall gather from the four corners of the earth. And the envy of Ephraim shall cease, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, nor shall Judah vex Ephraim. And they shall fly of one accord against the Philistines in the west. Together they shall plunder the children of the east. Upon Edom and Moab shall they stretch forth their hand, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. And God shall dry up the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and he shall lift his hand over the river with the strength of his wind, and he shall beat it into seven streams, and he shall lead the exiles with shoes. And there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people who remain from Assyria, as there was for Israel on the day they went up from the land.
Thank you. So famously, Maimonides writes regarding these prophecies that we don't know what exactly these prophecies mean until they play out. We don't know which ones are meant to be taken literally, which ones are figurative and have other sorts of meanings. So Maimonides says, we will figure it out when we figure it out. But here is what I want to point out. What the prophet Isaiah, one thing that he definitely includes is a mention of shoes. He talks about how God will dry up the Egyptian sea, evoking the exodus and the splitting of the sea that happened with the exodus from Egypt. Once again, the sea, some sort of sea, will dry up. And the exiles, the remnant of Israel, the exiles, the Jews, that have been dispersed in the diaspora throughout exile will return to the land of Israel, and they will be led by God with their shoes. And my question is, if holiness is associated with lack of footwear in the Messianic era, you would think, is it a holy time or not a holy time? Holy time. If Mashiach is a holy time, why are you leading with shoes? It seems to go against, fly in the face of everything that we said until now. In other words, we've established thus far that whether it's time or space, when it's holy, we don't wear shoes. So in time on Yom Kippur, we don't wear shoes. In space in the temple or by the burning bush, we don't wear shoes. At a time, the Messianic era, when we're returning to Israel, you would think that we would return without shoes. Here it says God will bring them back. V'hadrich bana olam, he will bring them back and lead them with their shoes. What's going on? Why are they wearing the shoes?
Could it be that shoes here represent well-being or wealth? That we talk about people that don't have any money or not being able to afford shoes. So at that time, we'll have plenty. So we'll have shoes.
We'll have shoes for everybody.
Right.
I hear you, but sticking with the theme that we've been exploring, that when things are holy, for some reason we're trying to not be disconnected from the earth. How does this fit in with that theme?
Isn't it about bringing Messianic consciousness to the earth, which is symbolized with shoes?
So then why in the other instances, why in Yom Kippur don't we wear shoes? If there's some advantage of shoes. You're touching on a good point. Let's bring it home by exploring the Kabbalistic understanding of shoes. So take a look at text number 14. Here is the critical text that is the key to understanding the mystical meaning of shoes. Text 14. Please read text 14. What page are we on? 241.
Shoes represent the creation of a barrier or buffer between man and the ground, earthiness and materiality. A person's head is naturally higher and removed from the earth, just as one's upper limbs and superior faculties are naturally at a loftier level removed from the material. However, the lower part of one's body, that is the feet, is naturally closer to the earth and tends to earthy material things. Therefore, there is a need to don shoes in order to create an interruption between even the lower part of man and the earth, so that even this part within man does not sink entirely into earthiness and the material. All of this is so with regards to the profane. However, when in the presence of holy ground, there is no need to intervene between the person and the ground. On the contrary, in such a place, one ought specifically to go barefoot, so that there should be no barrier between him or her and the ground.
Thank you. So this is a psychological and spiritual explanation of what are shoes, and what is the ground, and what are shoes, and why sometimes we should wear shoes and sometimes we shouldn't wear shoes. Forget the shoes for a moment. Let's speak spiritually. Let's speak psychologically. Let's speak emotionally. So, in a situation where a person is confronted with challenge to their ideas, to the core of what they stand for. So sometimes when you're in a hostile environment, you need to put up a barrier, something to protect yourself against the hostility. The direct analog that the Rebbe gives here in this explanation, text 14, is when it comes to spirituality and materialism. Living in a world of materialism and trying to live a spiritual life means that there are a lot of things that you're going to have to, in a sense, create a barrier for yourself to protect yourself against. So to jump into everything head first or feet first is not going to be a healthy situation if you're trying to maintain your spiritual posture, if you're trying to maintain your spiritual dignity. If you jump into everything, every material indulgence, every temptation, every desire, every piece, every area of quicksand that you encounter, you're going to jump into, you're quickly going to sink in a spiritual way. And so what's needed is to create a barrier between yourself and the earthiness, the materialism of this world. That is symbolized by the shoes. Just like physical shoes, at least originally, were intended to protect the feet against the things that could harm the foot, when stepping on the coarse ground outside, rocks and sharp things and objects and snakes and whatever it was that, you know, the original intention to protect the foot against, just like physical shoes are meant to protect the physical foot against physical harm, spiritually, shoes are intended or needed to protect the soul and the human being against those material things that threaten our spiritual integrity. Make sense? So when a person roams this earth and we walk on a very materialistic earth, in a world that promotes physicality and promotes materialistic things, and we're trying to maintain our spiritual integrity, it's important, it's necessary to create a buffer. In other words, I'm going to, for example, go to work, but I'm not going to get involved in the gossip and defaming of someone else while I'm at work. So I'm going to enter the fray a little bit, but I'm going to keep a barrier, right? I'm going to go to work and earn money, but I'm not going to cut some corners and lie and cheat a little bit because everyone else does it to earn a few extra bucks. In other words, even though I'm in the world, I'm not going to become earthly. I'm not going to become materialistic. I'm not going to succumb to the temptations of the earth. I'm rather going to maintain a certain distance even as I step on the ground. Does that make sense? So I'm going to be I will be in the world, but I will not be of the world. I'm going to be part of society, but I'm not going to become totally, I'm not going to drown within what society tells me I need to do. I'm maintaining a certain measure of distance, of separation from the earth. So that's how the Rebbe explains the general spiritual notion of shoes. And basically, shoes are something that we all need to wear as long as we're here, as long as we're in this earth. As long as the soul is in a body, in this environment, we need to wear shoes. We can't just say, hey, let's embrace it. We live here. This is what we're going to do. We're going to indulge and lie, cheat, and steal and run after every temptation and live a hedonistic life, and that's it. No, we're told that we put on shoes to keep us a little bit separated from the earthiness, from that which can sink us. When you're standing on hallowed ground, when you're standing in a holy place, when you're in a physical place that doesn't have with it any temptation, if the physical ground is already holy, then you don't need any shoes. If you're in the temple of old, the ancient holy temple in Jerusalem, you're not just on any ground. You're in the holy space of the holy temple. A place where the earth itself is filled with an awareness, with a divine consciousness. So then at that moment, you're not filled with any temptation. There's nothing to protect yourself against.
You don't want to separate yourself.
One second, that's the second point. So number one, you don't need that barrier of protection. And number two, you don't want it. Because you want to be connected with the spirit of the place. You want to be firmly grounded as much as possible in the hallowed ground that you find yourself in. You want to sink in the experience. You want to have a full experience without any barriers, any separation. So most of the time as we walk through this earth, we need to keep an arm's distance, an arm's length. We have to keep ourselves a little bit separated from the experience because it might sink us. It could harm us if we get too entrenched, too enmeshed within it. But sometimes, if it's a holy experience, we can jump totally all in, head first, feet first. We're all in. Why? Because it's not going to bring about any harm, any materialistic harm, God forbid. On the contrary, it's only going to bring benefit. With this, we've answered most of the questions. With this one perspective, we've answered most of the questions. Typically, we all need to wear shoes. Not physically, spiritually, we all need to wear shoes while roaming this earth. However, the exception is, if you're Moses speaking to God at the burning bush, that place, at that moment, is hallowed ground. It's a holy place. Take off your shoes. Be involved. Don't, when you're speaking to God directly face to face, Don't keep up any guards. Don't put up any walls. Don't put up any barriers of separation. Don't say, God, I'm in it a little bit, but I'm staying cautious because I don't know what you're going to ask me. No, go all in. Take off your shoes. When you're in the temple, whether you're the priest doing the service or you're visiting the Temple Mount, jump all in. Don't put up any barriers. Don't be cautious with God. Don't say, God, I'm being guarded. I don't know what you're going to ask. Maybe I'll commit. Maybe I won't commit. Jump all in. Take off your shoes when you're in the temple. On Yom Kippur, take off your shoes. Why take off your shoes? It's a day of holiness. It's a day of divinity. It's a day to be one at one minute, to be one with God. Jump head first. Jump feet first. Go all in. No need for barriers. No need to throw caution to the wind. Jump all the way in. No separations, no barriers, no obstructions, full connection. However, Yom Kippur, before Yom Kippur, however, not the entire world. The entire world is not the burning bush. And the entire world is not the Holy Temple. And the entire year is not Yom Kippur. Most of the time, the day after Yom Kippur, we have to put the shoes back on. The day after Yom Kippur, we have to once again be careful. Because it's not a day, the day after Yom Kippur, it's not a day filled with holiness. It's a day in which we are tempted by materialistic temptations. And we're challenged by temptations. And in order to succeed, in order to overcome those things that could trip us up, that could harm us, we need to create that barrier. We need to put on that layer of protection that keeps us a little bit removed from the materialism. But know this. Kabbalah teaches that the purpose of life, the tachlit, the purpose is not Yom Kippur. The purpose is, in fact, the day after Yom Kippur. This is not necessarily a great message as we get ready for Yom Kippur, but I'm kidding, it's a great message. The purpose is, the ultimate is not Yom Kippur. It's the day after and the day before. And right now. The ultimate is not living in a space that is so spiritual and so holy that you don't even feel any temptation. God put us here on this earth so that we should feel temptation. And we should feel the challenge. And we should find things to be difficult. Doing the right thing, we should find it to be difficult. And we should still muster the strength and summon the inner courage to make the right choices and to do the right thing by creating that buffer, that barrier of separation that is the footwear. In other words, God wants us not to be angels 24/7, 365. God wants us to be human beings. God does not want the perfection of the angels that he has for the angels in heaven and that he has with us once a year. God does not want the perfection of angels. God wants the struggles and challenges of the human being. In other words, wearing shoes and roaming a very materialistic earth is where we're meant to be and what we're meant to be doing. Why? Number one, it brings out, it summons forth a greater strength within us. Living in this idealistic environment, the spiritual environment, whether it's the land near the burning bush or the land of the ground of the temple or a Yom Kippur, that is a spiritual bubble, and that is not sustainable. And it's not a place that summons any courage or strength within us. But living in a material place at a material time, that materialistic time, that evokes within us a greater strength. That's the first point of why it's advantageous. The second point, this is really the main point here, and that is we make an impact on the world when we step on the earth wearing shoes. That's when we make a difference. On Yom Kippur, we're not transforming the world. We're enjoying the spiritual beauty that already exists. The day after Yom Kippur, you walk out, and now you're faced with all of these temptations. Real life resumes. You're out of the synagogue. You're back at work. And all of the stuff comes back right in front of your eyes. And now the question is, are you going to make the right choice? Or are you going to make the easy choice, which is not the right choice? Which one are you going to make? Are you going to make the right choice? Or you make the choice that feels good in the moment, right? Are you going to make the holy choice or the unholy choice? And if you make the right choice, if you make the holy choice, which is a little bit difficult and requires that perspective, that little barrier of separation to gain that perspective and that and that uh, and that vision and that clarity. If you're able to make the right choice, then not only are you stronger in the process, but you've transformed that moment and that experience to become a holy experience, a holy moment, and a holy place. If you're able to say, if you're able to walk by that temptation and say, I'm not going to get distracted, or if you're able to reject that opportunity that comes in front of you that's a little bit dishonest and say, I'm not going to take that opportunity. If you're able to do that, you transform that moment, that experience, that place, that entire setting, and you transform it into a godly experience. And that's why we're here. We're not here to celebrate, to exalt in this spiritual glory and the holy environment of Yom Kippurs and temples. We're meant to walk the earth, to roam the materialistic earth, and make a difference with every step along the way with our shoes. And that's why Isaiah writes, when Mashiach comes, we're wearing our shoes. Mm-hmm. Why? Because when Mashiach comes, although it's a beautiful world, it's a holy world, it's a world that is made holy, not artificially, not from top down, not that God gives us this opening, this vision of a temple or a burning bush or a Yom Kippur from on high, but it's a beautiful world, it's a better world that we've created through our hard work, through wearing the shoes every single day, through maintaining perspective through thick and thin, doing the right thing even when it's difficult. And therefore, to truly experience the Messianic era, to truly experience the times of Mashiach, we're going to be wearing our shoes to remind us that it's the shoes that get us to the Promised Land. It's the shoes that pave the way to a better world. It's the shoes in our lives that help us make the right choice, even when things seem very difficult. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Jews in Shoes.